We're discussing the massive stimulus relief package and one aspect of it that would pay off federal loans and expand land access for farmers of color. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack spoke with NPR's All Things Considered Saturday about how black farmers have faced generations of systemic discrimination.
The fact is that there was discrimination in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s at USDA that made it very difficult for socially disadvantaged producers to access fully and completely the programs at USDA. And the result, of course, is that over a period of time, they get further and further behind.
Do you have a connection to the legacy of black farming in America? What can you share about your experience in agriculture? 800-642-1234. Savi Horn is an attorney and executive director of the Land Loss Prevention Project. It's based in Durham, North Carolina. Savi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Wow. Kate, thank you. Thank you for this invitation.
Well, can you explain for us what this $5 billion means for farmers of color?
Sure. And I just want to thank you again for this opportunity. So I think the main takeaway that I would like to uplift for our listeners is that the BIPOC legislation really goes deeply into what we believe are current justice issues that have been longstanding in the agency. It is carefully crafted and considered. The findings undergirding this legislation is clearly spelled out in the act. And the legislation provides $4 billion in direct payments to help farmers of color pay off outstanding USDA loan debts and related taxes. And that's key. The money is not the money will eventually benefit the USDA and retire debts so that BIPOC farmer, black, indigenous, people of color farmer can get out of debt.
And the package also sets aside money for an equity commission, agricultural training, land access programs. What impact will this part of it make?
Well, I think the only way you can root out systemic discrimination, as you know, been studies. There's been commissions to look at this problem. There has been a class action that has been settled. But this is like continuing discrimination and discrimination that was not cured in the past, and farmers, they are still in debt. And so we believe that by getting at the debt and looking at equity, and equity is a big part of this legislative package in the sense that monies is already appropriated in the legislation to look at fixing the equity, the disparity problems that the USDA has been experiencing for decades. Our farmers have experienced it. We've seen the tremendous land loss, and now we have seen the impact, the cumulative impact of this during the COVID period, in which our farmers, BIPOC farmers, suffered disproportionately from health issues and deaths due to COVID.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Savi Horn, who is an attorney and executive director of the Land Loss Prevention Project. We're talking about farmers of color and especially black farmers who have faced decades of discrimination by federal officials, federal programs. We're looking at the implications. With your questions, what do you want to know about the history of black farming in America? 800-642-1234. Savi, can you explain how over the last century, how black farmers have lost their land, have not received equal access to USDA programs?
Okay, so thanks for that question. Well, when you look at the fact that 50 years after the end of slavery, by 1910, African Americans had over 15 million acres of farmland with close to a million farmers, if you will. Farmers working full-time, part-time, and tenant farmers farming this land. And that by the Great Depression, that was reduced to half. And during the period when we were fighting for our social, economic, and political rights, which is known as the Civil Rights Era, Black land ownership drastically fell to 6 million acres. So you're going from 15 million to 6, and it's even more drastically reduced. I can let folk know that between 1954 and 69, the number of full-time operators that were African-Americans dropped from 126,000 to 52,000. That's a 59% decline, 59% decline. And I can, you know, because we're based in North Carolina, dig a little deeper just to kind of just show you just like the numbers are not lying. And the objective conditions that led to it is being addressed in this new BIPOC legislation. And this is the reason. The reason was that between 1954 to 1969, and that is a classic period of the civil rights movement in North Carolina. In 1954, you had close to 1.1 million acres of land being held by Black farmers. And by 1969, you had 558,000. That's a 49% wow. decline. Now, when you look further at the data, you will notice that by 1978, okay, it showed 400,000 acres. And that by 2007, there were only 133,000 acres of land.
Drastic reduction of land ownership.
Yes. And so folk like to say, well, it's all heirs' property, you know, like it's all Black people kind of getting at themselves and squabbling and seizing land. No, those seizures were happening under state law and being facilitated by developers and other forces that were seeking Black-owned land. And the USDA played an outsized role in terms of the discriminatory impact of its loan system, the way the county committees did not support the recovery of Black farmers through disaster payments, through emergency loans. This became cumulative.
Why?
And we now see where we're at today.
Why could the USDA go unchecked like this?
Well, there were a number of tries to uncheck. I mean, you got to look back in the times that this was happening and the political persuasion of the country. So that even in 1982, when you had the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, the Commission on Civil Rights, doing a study on Black farmers and squarely found, you know, that most Black farmers were being denied access to USDA programs, and as a direct result of being shut out, that Black farmers in another 10 to 15 years would not survive as a distinct sector within the U.S. agriculture system. So findings after findings, congressional hearings, but you still had a recalcitrancy at the local level where that the persuasion held sway that Black farmers were going to be shut out of access to USDA programs. Yeah, they'll get some loans, but it was so late in the season that it didn't matter.
Savvy Horn, she leads the Land Loss Prevention Project, founded nearly 40 years ago by the North Carolina Association of Black Farmers to reconcile epidemic losses of Black-owned land. What are your thoughts on these provisions addressing the needs of Black farmers? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Savvy Horn here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing a part of the COVID relief package aimed at benefiting farmers of color who are socially disadvantaged, specifically the historic inequities Black farmers have faced through the decades we've been learning about here. Farmers of all backgrounds will share in $10.4 billion through the American Rescue Plan. Almost half of those funds are set aside for debt forgiveness for minority farmers. How do you think the USDA should make up for past discriminatory practices? What do you think of a new equity commission to study how the USDA works? Join in 800-642-1234. Savi Horn is executive director of the Land Loss Prevention Project, and she stays with us. Let's bring in a call now. Jeff is joining us from Delafield. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question on the statistics of the number of the reduction in the number of Black-owned farms over the years. It's an interesting statistic, but we've seen the same thing in Wisconsin with the loss of family-owned dairy farms. There's been article after article written about that, and probably call-in programs on this very radio station about how we're losing our small family farms, and that's really due to changes in agricultural practices, the bigger getting bigger and pushing out the small of all colors. So I'm wondering how much of that loss of Black-owned farms is simply due to changes in agricultural practices rather than discriminatory practices, not that there aren't any, in the USDA. Thank you.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you. Savi.
Yes, that's a good question. But the answer is that the discrimination against African American, Native American is rooted in racism and systemic exclusion based on race and ethnicity. And yes, I do agree with you that there has been losses in the dairy industry, but what we're saying is that BIPOC farmer, yes, they lost land and resources due to economic pressure that were market driven, but because of their exclusion, they were never able to make that transformation where they could actually participate and become larger players within the U.S. agricultural system. They never got from base one to base two, and they couldn't hit the home run because of how the system had been historically structured to make sure that they wouldn't thrive.
Can you
And I think that's what we got to remember. They couldn't thrive.
Can you explain how the Pigford settlements were handled and how that layers into this? The USDA paid out $2.3 billion to Black farmers through two class action lawsuit settlements, Pigford 1 and Pigford 2. What happened there? What did you see?
Well, I think on the Pigford 1 and 2, you had close to about $1.5 billion in settlement, but it didn't go far enough in terms of the debt relief and definitely didn't get to the place of debt cancellation. And then there were also continuing discrimination. You still had a pileup of civil rights complaint waiting to be adjudicated and determined at the agency that sat there, and some of them are still there today. So for many in Pigford, the settlement was not enough. There was no healing. There was no real transformation of the agency in terms of the endemic and systemic discrimination and the curing of that.
Do you
I don't think Congress made a mistake. They clearly laid out the findings, and it's about mass and systemic loss of farmland due to racial discrimination.
Savi, do you consider this rescue package and this piece of it, do you consider this to be reparations for Black farmers?
Absolutely, I do not. I think in the jubilance, if you will, Kate, of having such a victory, I mean, this was momentous, that some of us leap to that conclusion. But that conclusion is problematic because the money is not going to repair the farmers. It's not going directly to them. It's going to cancel debt, and this debt money will return to the agency as paid, and the extra bit of money that's in there will retire the taxes associated with that. So the farmer walks away from it whole in the sense that you're debt-free, but you still will have to figure out how you can re-enter agriculture. And that's the key to this provision, that it has those pieces of how to re-enter and replant African-American, Hispanic, Latinx, and indigenous people in rural communities. When you look at the studies that have been done by William Darity, a professor of public policy at Duke, he himself said flat out that this was pittance, and that when you look at the metrics going back to the zenith of Black land ownership, that you'd be looking at 250 to 350 billions. I think also Professor, let me get his name right, I'm just going to cut it short, Hikmet at Amherst College, he did a study looking at the classic civil rights period and found that Black farmers were losing land at 330 acres per year, and that when he adjusted for the value during that period, it was about $1 billion, but in today's dollar, close to between $8 to $10 billion. So no, this is not reparations. It's not going to the pocket of farmers. It's retiring debt owed to the government. Nobody is walking out with money in their pocket.
We're talking with Savi Horn, who leads the Land Loss Prevention Project. We're looking at the COVID relief package and the provision that will forgive debts for farmers of color. We're looking at the implications and the history. 800-642-1234. Susan is joining us from Richland Center. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm a white woman, and, you know, I've never been treated the greatest, but this is my problem. You know, it is not the farmers this today that caused all this, these problems. But now they're getting discriminated against. Isn't this discrimination against whites? I'm sorry that this happened, but I didn't do it. My ancestors did. So now we're going to do the same exact thing. We're going to keep out the white people because...
Susan, I want to pause here and allow Savi to respond.
Well, the thing is, this is not reparations. We're not going back to your grandfather. We are looking at continuing discrimination that is documented by the USDA that is continuing.
And
it is to rebalance the scale of justice, as Secretary Vilsack is saying. It's not going back in time to assess blame on the part of white folk on that piece of that historic journey, but to deal with the current discriminatory impact.
Very quickly, Savi, what is the significance of Senator Raphael Warnock from Georgia, the new Democratic senator, being the one who pushed this forward, sitting on the Senate's Agriculture Committee and bringing social justice to the body?
Well, thank you for that question, Kate, because when we center Reverend Warnock and we look, Senator, at where he's from, whence he came, and look at the fact that Southwest Georgia is part of the historical Black Belt of the South, a region that was subject to plantation, slavery, racial oppression, economic oppression, but also a region of hope. that had a forceful civil rights movement that made changes, right? Including the changes brought about by the movement led by Dr. Martin Luther King. So he is situated in a history that made what he attempted to do and has done significant. But he's building on a history of dealing with discrimination and forming measures to deal equitably and fairly within the structure.
Savi, thank you for joining us. Savi Horn is an attorney and executive director of the Land Loss Prevention Project. News is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As more Wisconsin residents become eligible for vaccination against COVID, more people will be on the hunt for vaccine appointments themselves. WPR's Bram Sable-Smith has been speaking with people who found appointments and has some tips.
Robin Davis was thrilled to learn her family was eligible for COVID-19 vaccines on March 1st. The 56-year-old has mostly hunkered down in her Milwaukee home with her son and daughter, both adults on the autism spectrum.
Very depressing because we've been at home 24/7.
Davis has her own physical disabilities, and all three of them are part of Wisconsin's self-directed program for adults with disabilities. That's how they qualified for the vaccine. But like many in Wisconsin, Davis was uncertain about how to book an appointment. That's when she saw a news story about a Facebook group where Wisconsinites were sharing tips about finding a shot.
And so I requested to join right away. And then I told my story. And then Bob, he said to direct message him. I did that.
Bob is Bob Orrick, a retail manager in Germantown, who started the Facebook group Milwaukee and Wisconsin Area Vaccine Hunters and Angels.
That one became like my own personal mission to get them, all three of them, vaccinated.
Orrick connected Davis with a Walgreens pharmacist he had met through the group. She and her children were vaccinated the next day. It's one of many success stories for the group that has something of a mantra: ask for help.
And to see all the positive that this page is doing and all these messages, DMs, and text messages I'm getting, that's what's been so just kind of inspiring with all this.
Scheduling vaccine appointments can be more straightforward. That doesn't mean it's easy, though. Here are some tips that other Wisconsin residents have found successful. The first is to go through your medical provider. That's what 67-year-old Lisa Kirchberg did. She got a letter from her doctor saying she was eligible and could book an appointment over the phone. She followed the instructions and received her first dose in February.
And they were very good there. You know, they had you sit for 15 minutes and, you know, it was real clean and good spacing. And, you know, some places aren't like that, but it was. So that was nice.
Each medical provider has its own system for booking vaccine appointments, and tip number two is to research where to go. The state maintains a searchable map of vaccine providers, but appointment slots can fill up fast. Bob Orrick says members of his group glean patterns revealing the best time to book at certain locations. Walgreens, for example, seems to open new appointments at 6 a.m. daily, a worm for the early birds. Orrick says they're still trying to figure out the other pharmacies, like CVS.
So they're still kind of a nut to uncrack.
Being willing to travel can possibly open up more appointments as well. Tip number three, ask for leftovers. Some providers will have leftover vaccine doses at the end of the day because of canceled appointments. Rather than letting them go to waste, Orrick says some have lists of people that can show up on short notice.
And I will tell you, it is working with people getting doses that way.
Now, if it seems like these tips for booking appointments favors the tech savvy and people with time, you're not alone. Hashim Zabak noticed the same thing. He's a founder and pharmacist at Hyatt Pharmacy in Milwaukee. Their solution is to offer walk-in appointments that allow people to forgo the online booking process altogether.
We've had slow days when we just vaccinated 50 or 60 people, and we've had some really, really busy days that we were getting close to 1,000 a day.
Regardless of how you approach it, there is one more tip for getting a vaccine. Be patient. The state is making progress, and the general population is expected to be eligible in May. Bram Sable-Smith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And that story comes from a reporting partnership between WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Now, the massive stimulus package makes some big changes to the child tax credit, like increasing its value, expanding it to include 17-year-olds, and making it fully refundable, meaning that low-income families would get more money back. We will look into all the particulars with your questions front and center. What do you think of spreading out the tax benefit into payments versus getting one lump sum at tax time? Will the credit improve the financial outlook for your family? What do you think of how it's structured? 800-642-1234. Chris Cox is Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute. Chris, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So a top line change here, 17-year-olds now qualify for this credit. Can you explain what else happens here? What changes did Congress make to the child tax credit?
Yeah, so a really significant part of the changes to the child tax credit is that the credit will now provide support to tens of millions of children. In fact, the law makes the credit bigger for 90% of children across the country and in Wisconsin. And this increase in the child tax credit starts phasing out or being reduced for married couples making more than $150,000 and heads of households making more than $112,500. So again, more than 90% of children or almost all families will see an increase in their benefit. And this increase is especially important to the one-third of all children, those in families with the lowest incomes, who will for the first time be eligible for the full child tax credit, even if their families have low or no earnings. And just to put this in context, today more than 10 million children live in poverty across the country. This law will lift over 4 million of them above the poverty line, a 40% reduction. And those kids will be eligible for the full credit for the first time. So this is really a historic change.
Historic change, how much will families receive?
So the law increases the credit from $2,000 per child to $3,000 for children under 18, or $3,600 for young kids age 0 to 5. And this larger amount recognizes that investing in children can have large and long-lasting benefits for both those children, their families, and our broader society. We know that children who grow up in homes with more income grow up healthier, do better in school, and earn more as adults. So this law would put money in the pockets, especially of low and middle income families, to help them support their children.
And this is also looking at spreading out payments instead of doing it all at tax time. What do these payments look like? How would that work?
Yeah, so that's another great thing about this provision. So unlike most tax credits where families get it when they file their taxes, in this case, the IRS will send half of the credit later this year, and then families will get the other half next year at tax time. So this puts money into the pockets of low and moderate income families earlier than with most tax credits. And receiving this substantial amount of money throughout the year can help families pay rent, put food on the table, keep the heat and lights on, buy diapers, and meet other ongoing costs of raising children. Now, the bill was just signed last Thursday, so the IRS needs some time to figure out precisely how the payments will be delivered and when. They'll come possibly as soon as July, but what we do know is that half of the credit will be delivered this year, and families will claim the other half when they file their taxes next year.
There's been some questions as to whether the IRS is able to, you know, to be able to rise to this challenge of spreading out this credit. Is that going to take some doing?
This is a different structure than the IRS has worked with before. So this is a big task, and the IRS knows that it has this big task at hand. So it may take some time for the agency to figure out precisely how it will be delivered. Again, what we do know from the law is that the IRS will deliver half of it this year, and families will claim the other half at tax time next year. So in order to receive the payment this year, parents should file a 2020 tax return now so that the IRS has their information. And then they'll file a 2021 tax return next year to claim the other half of the credit. So it's really important, especially for people who haven't been required to file before or don't typically file returns. It's crucial that anyone with children file a tax return to claim the benefit so that the IRS has their information.
What if your family circumstances change during the year? You have more income or less income than shown on your return that you file with the IRS?
So the way the child tax credit is structured, people with incomes up to the phase out thresholds, up to about $150,000 for married couples or $112,000 for heads of households, the amount of their child tax credit will not change. And again, that's part of the historic change in this bill, is that no longer does the credit depend on a family's earnings, especially if they're low income. But all families up to that limit will receive the full child tax credit. So even if people's income changes during the year, as long as it stays under that limit, they will be eligible for the same amount. Where we do have concerns is if a child moves homes. So if they live with one parent for part of the year and another parent for part of the year, one parent may receive some money in advance, but the other parent may be eligible at the end of the year. The IRS has been directed to set up a way for families to report when their children move from home to home. And that's part of what the IRS needs to figure out to ensure that the advance payments and the full credit run smoothly.
These advance payments and this whole payment system, will there be reductions for taxpayers who owe back taxes or child support?
So the refundable tax credits are generally protected from offset.
Okay.
So I would need to get back to you about precisely which specific offsets would be excluded from this. But for the most part, the advance amount would come to families this year, regardless of those issues.
Your organization, the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, it's analyzed the effects of this payment program, this, you know, spreading out payments. What have you found? Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about sizable amounts here. With the increase in the credit, families would be eligible for $3,600 per child per year for young children and $3,000 for children aged 6 to 17. As long as families are able to report their family circumstances and the IRS has accurate information, it can make a lot of sense to send that money throughout the year to help families with their ongoing expenses. What we're concerned about is making sure that people, especially low-income families, don't owe money back to the IRS at the end of the year. And this is something, again, that the IRS is figuring out as they work through the details of the bill.
Chris Cox is with us with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities as we look at the changes to the child tax credit laid out in the federal COVID relief package. Do you understand whether your family qualifies and the income limits? Households may opt into recurring payments beginning probably in July. What do you think of spreading out the credit? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Chris Cox here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about the child tax credit. The fact is, it is expensive to raise kids. Make no bones about it. And the child tax credit is set to undergo big changes in the American Rescue Plan, the massive relief bill signed into law by President Biden. We're learning how it compares to the current child tax credit and what it means for families this year. Chris Cox of the Nonprofit Center on Budget and Policy Priorities is with us for 10 more minutes. Chris, moving to Wisconsin, what will the expanded child tax credit mean for kids here in Wisconsin?
So as I mentioned, 90% of children in the country and in Wisconsin will see their credit increase, which equals 1.2 million kids in Wisconsin who will benefit from this change. And again, the change is especially important to low and moderate income families. So previously, the credit delivered the smallest benefits to children who needed it the most. 27 million kids across the country didn't get the full credit because their families didn't earn enough. Now, this included half of all Black and Latino children across the country and half of all children living in rural areas. They didn't get the full credit because their families' incomes were too low. So the big change here is that this new law ensures that those kids get the same tax credit as kids in upper income families. And 368,000 kids in Wisconsin were in that boat. They were locked out of the full credit because their families' incomes were too low. Those kids will now receive the full amount of the child tax credit for the first time.
Does that mean that, you know, we keep hearing that the child tax credit is fully refundable for 2021? Can you explain that a little bit further, what that means?
So previously, the credit was limited based on how much a family earned and how much they owed in taxes. Making the credit fully refundable means that all families, except very upper income families, all families will be eligible for the same amount of the credit, regardless of their earnings or how much they owe in taxes. So think about it this way. Previously, if you were a married couple making $400,000 a year, you got $2,000 per kid. But if you were a single mom making $10,000 a year with two kids, you only got $600 per child from the child tax credit. It was completely upside down. The kids who needed it the most ended up getting the least. Now, families, regardless of their incomes underneath the threshold, will all be eligible for $3,600 for their young kids age 0 to 5 and $3,000 for their kids age 6 to 17. So this is such a crucial change. And it recognizes, as we've acutely seen over the last year, that sometimes when people are unemployed or underemployed, it can be through no fault of their own, and they still have to take care of their families and their children.
This sounds a bit like what other countries have done with a child allowance. What does this program look like when you look around the world?
That's right. So many high-income countries around the world have what they refer to as a child allowance, which just means that instead of getting a tax credit at the end of the year, the government provides regular income support to parents throughout the year. So in many ways, making the child tax credit fully refundable is like the U.S. catching up to the rest of the world.
When you look at the rest of the world, higher income countries, what have been the benefits? What have you found when they have provided this allowance?
So we know that children who grow up in homes with higher incomes do better in school. They grow up healthier. They earn more as adults. So child allowances really recognize the importance of investing in children, and especially investing in children who are experiencing poverty or who are in poverty for a long period of time. So expanding the credit in this way is significantly reducing child poverty in the U.S. and recognizes that the fates of millions of children are at stake.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Chris Cox, who is Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a nonpartisan research institute, and we're discussing the particulars of the expanded child tax credit this year, what it means for families, and taking your questions on it as well. Are you a parent or a guardian of a child under 18? What questions do you have about the new payment system for parents? It's part of the latest stimulus bill, 800 800-642-1234. We heard from Linda, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Linda wants to know, what happens to health insurance when parents receive funds through this tax credit for children? Is this credit considered income, is what Linda is asking.
That's a great question from Linda. Refundable tax credits, which the child tax credit is, are not considered income for the purposes of other federally funded benefit programs. So receiving the child tax credit will not affect anyone's eligibility for programs such as Medicaid or SNAP or other federally funded programs.
Anne from Wales called in, couldn't stay, and Anne wants to know if families will have to pay taxes on these payments.
Tax credits are not subject to tax, so this would be, this is effectively like similar to the tax refund that families would receive at the end of the year. It's not considered part of income for tax purposes. Tax would not be charged on this amount.
Looking at politics and Congress, do you think that the higher child tax credit has legs? Will it stay in these, you know, advance payments? Do you think this type of system will be made permanent?
Yeah, it's a really important question. I mean, look, this policy is a landmark achievement, but right now it is a one-year expansion. And it's vitally important that we make this change permanent. Nobody wants to see child poverty reduced by 40% this year and to see it double next year. So it's crucial that we continue this kind of investment, knowing that making this policy permanent would have a large and lasting impact on child poverty and on our well-being as a society.
So as this credit plays out, as this policy plays out, what will your center be watching for?
We really want to understand how to make the credit run even more smoothly, again, with a particular focus on making sure that low and moderate income households don't owe money back to the IRS by the nature of this advance payment. But we're also very excited about the anti-poverty impacts of this historic expansion and really understanding how this can make a difference in the lives of children, as research has showed it's done in other countries and even here in the U.S.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Cox is Deputy Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It is a nonprofit, nonpartisan research institute. Just ahead, it is the filibuster. We examine the Senate's supermajority requirement, making 60 votes needed to pass most bills. Do you agree with the filibuster rule, or should it be ended? Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.